Good afternoon. We'll call the meeting to order. Our regular chair is away at a funeral this afternoon, so you're stuck with me. That's the bad news. The good news is we're just going to have a public hearing, so I can't hurt you or help you one way or the other. So, given that, we do have a couple more members that we expect. Let's you won't be coming? Okay, let's open the public hearing on House Bill 2670. And we'll wait just a moment, and Janet can tell us everything we need to know about this bill.
And then some, Father.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2670 would set up a franchise law for recreational vehicle dealers. Oregon currently has franchise laws for motor vehicle dealers, but it does not cover recreational vehicle dealers. So it would prescribe manufacturer and distributor obligations toward dealers of recreational vehicles and prescribe terms in the recreational vehicle franchise. One of the principal things it does is authorize civil action by a dealer for violations of the manufacturers or distributors under the franchise agreements. The franchise agreements would designate exclusive and non-exclusive sales areas and prohibit a franchisor from granting a franchise to a dealer, another dealer in an exclusive area. It requires the franchisor to sell vehicles to dealers according to published prices. Requires franchise agreement to specify obligations of a dealer to perform warranty service, as well as the compensation and time allowed for performing the warranty service. And finally, Mr. Chair, this allows a manufacturer or distributor from owning, operating, and controlling a dealership except on a temporary basis when a dealership is for sale. Mr. Chair, that's what I have for a summary, and the proponents of the bill are here.
Okay. Anyone have questions for Janet? Okay. Can we have Sean Miller and John Brenneman? You both are both four, so I assume you can sit next to each other without fighting.
Yeah, I'll sit next to John. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sean Miller. I represent the Oregon Recreational Vehicle Dealers Association. As you heard from Janet, the auto industry, as you know, has franchise agreements, franchise laws. They've been on the books for quite some time now in Oregon. I know Representative Zahner is actually working on a bill this session for farm implementation franchise agreements. There's something that's been putting on the books to establish a relationship in law between a dealer and a manufacturer. In the RV industry, there is no franchise law, and we were specifically left out of the auto franchise law because RVs are quite different, obviously, than the auto industry. The RV Dealers Association on a national level and the RV Manufacturers Association on a national level has been trying to negotiate a national agreement bill for Congress for over 10 years, and they haven't quite agreed on the exact language. They're very close on probably about 90% of the bill, but there's a couple different issues that they cannot quite get straight, and so they have been unable to pass something at the federal level. We have been working on a bill for about 5 years now, looking at different issues that are specific to Oregon, taking some of that national model and working with the manufacturers on coming up with an Oregon-specific franchise law. And although you do not have amendments before you by the work session, you will have amendments that are going to be agreed upon by the dealers and the manufacturers. So, again, the approach that we took on a state level is, you know, on an issue that can cause a lot of fighting because, again, you're putting something in statute that's going to stipulate the relationship between a dealer and a manufacturer. We've taken the approach with the manufacturers, which is John, Mr. Brenneman on my right, to come up with language that we all agree on. Again, I'd like to go through some of the provisions in the bill and talk about, I know Janet touched on a few, but I want to talk about the major provisions in the bill and why this would be a good piece of legislation, not only for the dealer, but for the manufacturer. The first substantial piece of the bill essentially requires the manufacturer and the dealer to have a signed dealer agreement. Right now, again, you have dealerships and you have manufacturers, and products are being sent to the dealerships, and in some cases they're done on a phone call. And there's actually no requirement, because we don't have a franchise law, to have a signed agreement. It's something that both the dealers and the manufacturers, and those of you who know good business practice, it's probably a very good business practice to put everything in writing. And again, these franchise agreements that will be signed by both the dealer and the manufacturer can be as complex as both parties decide, or they could be as simple as both parties describe. But again, it just mandates that they put something in writing. The next section of the bill deals with territories. As you know, in the auto industry, there is different territories. You don't see a Ford dealership on the other side of the street of a Ford dealership. They actually break those areas up and what is needed. This establishes, in the RV industry, is quite different, though, from the auto industry, and this will establish the territories and how they will be created and how that will be negotiated with the manufacturers over time. The next section of the bill deals with remedies that take place should a dealer fall out of grace with a manufacturer. Obviously, if a dealer is not doing what they are supposed to be doing in the relationship with the manufacturer, this describes how the manufacturer is able to get out of a franchise agreement.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Could you explain what falling out of grace with a manufacturer means, please?
I will. For instance, the conviction of a crime, felony. If let's say a dealer convicts a felony, let's say they lose their license. They do something in the state. You know, we are licensed at the state level, and you lose your license. Well, obviously that's falling out of a grace with the manufacturer. And so, nice try. The next section, and again, once the amendments come back, Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, we will get specific. You will have the specifics before you on the bill, and we will be able to go through those for you. Next section of the bill ensures an orderly process for the transfer of ownership upon the death of an owner. It talks about the succession to the family members, and so a manufacturer may not prohibit, let's say, a family owner or a family member from succeeding the ownership of the dealer in that agreement. However, there's provisions in there that have to show that they have been involved in the business and that is an appropriate transaction to keep that franchise agreement in place. The next section ensures that all manufacturers wish to sell RVs must offer wage rates to the dealer and provide service works for the parts and a markup and a warranty service. These are the different warranty obligations that as a manufacturer on several different parts, and again, this is one of the key points that both John's clients and I really negotiated, because in an RV, you not only have your engine and all your parts, but you have stoves, you have a number of items in RVs that make this a lot different than the auto industry. And so warranty obligations on all of these parts, which are many more than the auto, is a significant chapter in the bill. The next chapter deals with ensures that the dealer is not obligated to binding arbitration. There is a section that protects both the dealer and the manufacturer in the bill for actions or damages. Essentially, section 14 of the bill you know, if there's violations of any portion of the franchise law that either the grantor, and you'll see that phrase in the bill, the grantor, which is the manufacturer and the dealer, that they could obviously bring action against one another for violations in the bill. The next session protects the dealer from the manufacturer by prohibiting essentially unfair selling advantages by a company, by a grantor. This particular issue, and this is the last issue I'm going to touch on, deals with the company store concept, which is you have relationships between manufacturers and dealers, but manufacturers that sometimes can open up their own stores. You know, it like be in the auto industry, if you had open up a Ford manufacturer store to compete with the dealers. And this is something that we've agreed to. It's one issue that we are still crafting, and we're going to come back to the committee with agreed upon language on how to deal with manufacturers who want to have their own stores. One, and I want to point out for the committee, and I actually have met with Representative Beyer, and all of you should have a letter, because I know it was addressed to all the committee members, yes, by Johnston, Clifton, Larson, and Corson. And the letter is from Richard Larson, who is the attorney for Marathon, which is the large manufacturing plant of the big buses. These are the luxury buses. These are buses that are nicer than most homes. They're $1 million plus. They sell 60 or so a year. And they don't have a market for dealerships in Oregon. Again, they are the manufacturer and they are the seller. It's a very, very small market. And the company store issue that I just addressed, that's to deal with our relationship. These are manufacturers who have dealers that are selling their product. These are not, this bill is not to address those kind of circumstances where they are the manufacturer that does not have a dealer network. We are, and I have had a conversation with Richard Larson, and when we draft that particular language, we are going to take care of their concerns for Marathon. And I know I've already met with Representative Byron. I've given them our commitment to that when we do have some agreed upon language on that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you know, as you can see, this provides a fair and an equitable playing field for both the manufacturer and the dealer. The end result to the dealer is that they have a tangible asset that cannot arbitrarily be taken away to, you know, him or her by a manufacturer. You know, and likewise for the manufacturer, it now offers a franchise agreement to the Oregon dealers, with a clear understanding to what is expected from day-to-day business. And that's all we're asking for. Again, the franchise agreement that this requires them to sign can be as complex or simple as the two parties want. This just puts the parameters around that agreement so we both understand the day-to-day business between them. It's very important for, I think, both of our industries that we accomplish this session. And again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've taken the approach not to fight over this issue in the halls of the Capitol. We've decided to bring forth language that that we all agree with, and there's been compromise on both sides. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and take John's information, and we'll ask the questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Brenneman. I've represented Recreational Vehicle Industries Association for about 8 years. I think this is my fourth session. RVIA is a trade association of manufacturers of RVs, tent trailers, campers, so on throughout the United States, and it's headquartered in Reston, Virginia. It was two sessions ago, actually, when the auto dealers were pushing their dealers' rights bill that we asked for an exemption. It was granted by the dealers because we promised them that we would come back actually last session and sit down in the interim and draft our own bill with them. That just didn't happen, and so here we are today, and we've done that. The original bill was put in by the dealers, and it uses an older version of language that was agreed upon nationally. And what we did and what's contained in the amendment that's coming is we began work on the later version, the 90s version of that, and so many of the areas are technical cleanups. What we're going to have in the House, as Sean aptly described, is the result of most of the issues that we have agreed on, and we still have a couple issues that one, in fact, on the buyback of parts and pieces that are around the state, as I had to present to Sean and his group as a deal breaker, but we offered as a trade-off some more pro-dealer language in the area of company stores. And I think the two of us are very close to having an agreement, and we'll know that tomorrow. We're going to have a telephone conference call to wrap it up. While we won't have all the language probably to complete here in the House version because we're running out of time, we're going to ask when the latest comes up from LC that let's chip it on, and Sean and I and our groups will finish up over on the other side. Marathon is not our member. They sell those luxury coaches. There's just not a dealership network that works for them, so people do come from all over the United States and make visits and watch their work in progress, and we've offered up some language that I know will work. It says it's in-state, and they don't have a dealership network that they're going to be exempt, so it's just a matter of us tomorrow completing that aspect of the whole bill. And I think we've done a very good job in sitting down and hammering through the issues we're going to have. I think a bill that nationally will get some attention.
Okay. Questions?
Mr. Chair, I don't really have a question. I just want to thank you for looking into that and taking care of it for me. I certainly appreciate it.
Questions? Apparently not. You guys hit a home run. I'm sorry.
Would it take a federal franchise law to take care of someone traveling and not being able to find someone to do warranty work? Or would this help at all, this bill help at all?
Mr. Chair, this is Atkins. It would if you're traveling nationally, because obviously without a national franchise agreement, if you buy a country coach and you drive to Arizona, they're not going to fall under the similar laws. And so, but what this does is it does protect that consumer within the state, and helps, you know, at least on some of the guidelines that the consumer is going to have within the state, protect them here. And that's actually a lot more than what we have now. Right now, if you buy from a dealer a certain make and you travel somewhere else, let's say, that might sell the same make, there's no requirement that they do the service work. Again, the only thing that you would have now, right, is you'd have to go back to that dealer to get the service work. You know, last session we required all dealers to have service centers. It was another way to move the industry for service, just like the auto industry, where you can. And again, we are moving that bill from last session with service, and this bill, I mean, we're moving towards that. The auto industry where you are able to travel, but this doesn't quite get it because it would take federal language if you go to another state.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but these coaches are built on Ford, Chevy, or Dodge chassis, and so you have the manufacturer of the coach that is warning some things, but you have the manufacturer of the engine, chassis, transmission, those kind of things that are the responsibility of the Ford or Chevy. And so you have mobility for those kind of things through dealerships nationwide. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, you probably would. However, one of the big differences in the RV industry is that you do have so many different kinds of manufactured products on the item. One of the items that, you know, we negotiated that, you know, the dealers are not going to get this session in the bill is the single source warranty, where you try to cover all the aspects of the dealer within one single source. we're not going to be able to handle that. It's something that we haven't quite worked out the details to. But like you said, there could be an engine drivetrain warranty with some manufacturer. There could be an appliances with another manufacturer. You actually have several, even though you have a manufacturer that's responsible for building the RV itself, within that you have several components that do not belong to that manufacturer. So there has, you know, eventually that'll be something we'll be working out over time. But that one's a hard one to crack.
Mr. Chair, John Brenneman again for the record. Ms. Atkins, there's a real problem nationwide on standards. Last session, the industry hired me to change the law in Oregon for the appendages that stick out on the sides, you know, the little lights, the handle, where you go in, the door sticks out further than the awning was a problem. And so we had to write a variance with Kelly Taylor last session to make those things legal. And they're picking off states across the nation to try and change it so that it's more uniform. But there's a lot of problems. And the warranty situation, you have a warranty on the TV, the stove, the refrigerator, the chassis. And a couple of sessions ago, I worked on the problem of lemon law. Because of the fact that it's so many complaints on warranty, you're racking up these vehicles and finding them as lemons much quicker than you would if you had a car, just because of all the various warranties. So there always seems to be an opportunity during session to come back and work for them again, because there's always something to fix.
This is the start.
Okay. Any final questions? Yes.
Well, this brings to mind, I had conversations with a constituent who was looking into the tinted window issue on motorhomes, and the fact that he had got it done out of state, and when he came back into state and wanted to have his windshield replaced, he could only get 7 inches. And he was looking into possibly changing the law, because it's 7 inches on all windshields. It's not just motorhomes. It's cars. And he was going to look at it nationally and see whether they wanted to do anything with it.
I'll bring you my card.
Well, okay, anything else?
Thanks.
Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing. Excuse me. Was anyone else that wasn't signed up wish to speak to this issue? Okay. Close the public hearing on 2670, and we'll open the public hearing on 2685. You want to give us a rundown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2685 would authorize ports and port districts to remove and dispose of abandoned boats, floating homes, and boathouses. It creates an abandoned boat removal and cleanup account and appropriates money from the account to the Marine Board for removal and cleanup of abandoned vessels. Increases the biennial boat registration fee by $1 for each kind of boat. And dedicates the additional revenue to the new account for the cleanup. It limits payment to ports to 75% of their cost for removal and cleanup, so they would have to find other sources of funding for the remainder. It also limits the use of funds to instances in which the port and the Marine Board have not been able to collect reimbursement from owners or insurance companies for the removal of the boat. Applies to boats under 200,000 gross tons, so we don't have any new Carissas that would be involved here. And the bill has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. The only thing we put at your place besides the staff manager summary is the process under current law for unclaimed property. This is not changed by the bill. This is the currently law enforcement has to go through this process when they remove a boat and how they can dispose of it. And this is the same process ports would have to use. So that's why it's referenced here. Under current law, law enforcement has to do this, and ports don't have any authority to.
Questions from Janet? Okay, should we call Ken Armstrong and Don Mann?
Good Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Ports Group. And I might inquire before I begin, Ms. Atkins, did you say they have the dash ones in front of them?
No.
Okay, I thought I had given you dash ones. Let me go ahead and give these to you so you can have them, but we'll deal with those at a later date. Essentially, those dash ones, pardon me, reflect some changes suggested by the State Marine Board, which we think are some good changes. Mostly make some technical fixes and some just to make the process work a little bit better. We can deal with those at such time that you bring this back at work session. But by way of just introductory comments before I introduce my colleague Don Mann. This represents some work on our part to find a way to deal with these vessels, primarily larger vessels, that find themselves into the waterways that are either a hazard to navigation or are a potential environmental hazard. Currently, under certain circumstances, depending upon the location of the vessel, that sort of thing, there's just really nobody who's going to take responsibility for getting it out of there. The boat owner is either not known, can't be reached, and there's no responsible party to take care of the vessel. Yet the fact remains that it is a hazard to navigation, and it is a potential environmental problem. And so the ports are interested in taking some responsibility upon ourselves, yet we just don't have the resources to deal with that. So what we are proposing is a $1 per biennium assessment on boat owners, boat registrations, to help build up a corpus of a fund, probably no more than about $200,000, to deal with that problem. Typically, if memory serves, I think we're looking at about maximum $30,000, $40,000 to deal with one vessel. So you can take care of several vessels within the amount of money that would be raised. There's something less than 200,000 boats statewide, so we're not talking about a huge amount of money. Paul Donhefner of the Marine Board has suggested we might want to think about capping the total amount at somewhere in the neighborhood of $200,000 to make sure that we see what sort of track record the fund is experiencing, so that if we're not seeing a lot of use of it in the first couple of years, we don't just continue to pile money into the fund and let it grow to some exorbitant level. So that's something that we're talking with the Marine Board about right now. But the bottom line is we've got a problem out there with these vessels. We need to find some way to clean them up, to get them out of the waterway. And ports thought that this made sense, that it was a creative and proactive sort of an approach. And I'd like to turn it over. Thank you very much. I'd like to turn it over to my colleague Don Mann, manager of the Port of Newport, to talk to you a little bit about some of the specifics in their port district, and he, as a matter of fact, is one of the ones that had the idea to begin with to bring this forward in legislation. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you. I have a couple little questions.
Sure.
What is the registration fee? Is it a standard, a set fee, or is it variable?
My understanding, Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, is that it is a set annual or biannual fee. Is that correct, Paul?
Yeah.
And it should be broken out in the bill, I
think.
It's
in the bill.
Yeah. No, that's
I'm
okay.
I'm going to show my lack of organization and say I didn't bring my bill file.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative
Beyer? Yeah, and when you're talking about the size of the boats, what percentage of the boats in Oregon would be under that size limit, the 200
gross tons?
About 85% of the registered.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, about 85%, it sounds like, and I'd also look back to Mr. Donhefner if that sounds about right to you.
Virtually all.
Yeah.
26 of them.
And I see we do have a boating expert in the back giving us a little thumbs up. That would be former Representative Terry Thompson.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I'm pretty familiar with a few ports winding around it in the boat I have. And I'm trying to think about, I'm trying to visualize what this problem is. I mean, what are these? Are these those boats that are sitting by a dock and a marina half sunk that's been there as long as I remember? Is that what we're talking about here?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think Don Mann is prepared to speak a little bit more directly to that question.
I'll
why don't I take that one on.
Wait till you're done. All right.
Okay, let's go ahead then, Don, with your...
Okay, Chairman Mabry and other members of the committee, I'm Don Mann. I'm the general manager of the Port of Newport, and also I'm the president of the Oregon Public Ports Association. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity today to support the creation of this abandoned boat removal and cleanup account. Special thanks and to Representative Brown, who's not here today. He's a former port commissioner. And thank him for his recognition of this specific issue, because he is used to the operations of ports and what we have to go through to deal with the removal and disposal of derelict and potentially environmental hazardous vessels. And this is a problem with all ports, not just any one particular port. And I'd also like to thank the Oregon State Marine Board Director Paul Don Hefner for his help and interest in recognizing the importance of providing yet another opportunity for ports and the Marine Board to cooperate in an effort to eliminate this potential problem. The proposal that you have, or the legislation that's proposed, provides a funding mechanism, as you heard from Ken, after all other avenues of revenues are exhausted. That means that the owner is no longer around. We cannot contact him. We've tried and researched any insurance that might be available for the vessel. And then that's when this particular account would be used for the vessels that we described, up to 200 gross tons. And it would include the salvage, the towing, storage, and or disposal of that vessel. To put in perspective, a 200-ton vessel, if you were familiar with any commercial vessels, 200 gross tons is a fairly large fishing vessel, and you'd be looking at about an 80 to 85 foot vessel. A bona fide steel vessel would be have a gross tonnage of about 200 tons, and we're looking at vessels of that size or lower that could be abandoned either in the district, port district area, at the marina, or in the river system. And we have some of those vessels in Newport at this time. I apologize. I don't have any examples of vessels in other ports, but we'll have an opportunity in the future. I hope to present you with some more information. There's been on occasion in our port alone, when these vessels are both recreation and commercial that we deal with, they've just been abandoned on the property or within our port jurisdiction, as I described. Port districts usually include the river system, estuaries. In this case, we have two port districts that are very close in on the Aquinnah Bay, and that's Newport and Toledo. And we both have problems with derelict vessels. Just recently, we had to take care of three of these types of vessels that were abandoned in our port. And what it takes is a lot of man hours and to remove these vessels from the water. We spent 44 man hours alone just on these three vessels, removing them from the river or the bay or the harbor, and bring them up on shore and getting ready to dispose of them. In the removal and disposal of these vessels, there was no assistance from the owners, nor was any insurance available that could be used. And I should add that the owners were nowhere to be found, and they don't always leave a forwarding address. This proposal authorizes the ports as well as law enforcement authorities to remove the boat, floating, home, or boathouse in custody, and remove the boat floating, whether it be the boathouse or a floating home. And it would also, we would like to add, and this will be in the amendments that you will see there, to remove abandoned piling and deadheads that also are dangerous to boaters. This is a good bill. It's an excellent tool for ports and Oregon State Marine Board, and the we urge your assistance in passing this proposed legislation. And one other, just a quick note that Ken showed me here. One of the vessels that we're dealt with on the Aquinnah Bay is about an 80-foot vessel that has sunk in the river, and we've had trouble with the getting this vessel out. It's an 80-footer, as I said, and it's sitting on the bottom right in the fishing, the sport fishing lanes, right on the edge of the navigation channel, about 5 miles up the Aquinnah River. And we've had no luck with assistance from the Coast Guard or the Division of State Lands or the Corps of Engineers in removing this vessel. It's all borderline of the way it is sitting on the bottom, whether or not it's a hazard to nav, it's not an environmental threat, and the Division of State Lands doesn't look at it as a vessel that needs to pay submerged lease. So it's just sitting there. It's in the way. It's a danger, especially when it's foggy. And these are one of the types of vessels that we're talking about that get abandoned by owners. And we're hoping that through this legislation, this will assist us in moving these types of vessels. I'll answer your questions.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up one brief point in response to Representative Greenland's question? Some of the vessels that we see are those that are in the marina that are half sunk, they're rotting, falling apart. That's really not what we're targeting. Those smaller vessels are ones that the port can fairly easily deal with. What we're talking about primarily are these vessels that get abandoned and find themselves on the bottom of a shipping channel, near the channel, somewhere that poses a more direct hazard to navigation. Sometimes they're entirely submerged, sometimes they're partially submerged, but it's really not those smaller wrecks that you see within a marina that we can handle fairly easily. They're the larger, somewhat more expensive projects. And I might also add that we are having some discussions, even moments before this hearing, with representatives of the recreational boating public. And we're trying to work through some of the issues with them. The question might be asked in your mind, if we're talking about these larger vessels, why are you dinging the recreational boaters? In our view, there's two answers to that. One, the recreational boaters are the ones that receive much of the benefit to having these the shipping channels, the navigation channels, maintained clear so that they can get their boats back and forth. So I think that there's a direct benefit to them for this. Secondarily, in our view, the Marine Board has several funding programs, facility grants, law enforcement, et cetera. Much of that is really directed at the recreational boater, not as much towards the commercial fisherman. We see this as something that is also providing some benefit to that side. So the pendulum kind of swings both ways a little bit. But as I say, I want to be real clear that we are having some discussions with the recreational boaters to try and reach some agreement, some accommodation here to make sure that everybody feels comfortable with where we're trying to get. Thank you.
Questions? Representative
Greenwood? Yeah, that's exactly where I was going. You figured it out. I mean, the biggest bulk of this expense will be with the 16-footer and less, and the sailboats. I mean, because that's where most of the boats are. And it does seem to me, if this is really a class of boat that's causing trouble, I mean, it doesn't seem to you that's the class of, I guess it's ship in this case, bigger than boat, that ought to be bearing the brunt of dealing with that problem. How did you come to this solution?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, frankly, the 200-ton limit was somewhat arbitrary. It was our evaluation and analysis to say, all right, how do we keep from getting to the new Carissa category, yet where are the size vessels that we're going to often see abandoned and that are of such size and could be such a potential problem, like the Margaret Ann, as Mr. Mann has described, that we had to kind of come up with some cutoff figure, and 200 tons seemed to make the most sense. And that was in consultation with representatives of the fishing industry and port folks and those others. But again, I think that I think there's a benefit certainly to the ports. There's a benefit to the recreational boater. There is a potential. It's not just going to pay for those boats that are 200 ton. I mean, it's the whole category all the way down to the 16-footers. My earlier statement was just that we don't see as many of the smaller boats that are a problem, but then there's going to be a whole range up to the 200 ton that potentially we could see some benefit from getting those things out of there.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I had a similar sort of follow-up on what Representative Greenland said. Is there any way to build in a cost recovery part of this program? In other words, when you're recovering, now I don't know if these vessels have been sitting down there for 20 years, but I would think that eventually you want to build in some cost recovery, because obviously if these are especially commercial fishing vessels, now I don't know if, you know, these are people who have gone bankrupt and it's going to be pretty hard to collect, but I guess concern about that it's going to be the bulk of the recreational fishing community that's bearing the cost, and I realize there's some benefits to all users of the ports and waterways, but just curious if you looked at all at trying to include some cost recovery.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, yes, we have. Two responses to that. First, recognize that in the bill there is a 25% match from the ports. The ports need to step up and pay a good portion of it. So we're going out on a limb to fix something that is technically speaking not our asset, meaning the navigation channel, to help leverage the dollars that the boating public is putting into this to get the project done. Beyond that, there continues to be the mechanism to get the insurance dollars once the recovery action takes place. Now, that is absolutely no guarantee that you're going to get the insurance dollars. So, to answer categorically, yes, there's a cost recovery mechanism. I can't say that. But there has been thought, and there is provisions to make sure that those dollars that get expended can then be recouped through the insurance industry when we're able to, you know, make a successful claim on the money.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, who owns all the docks down there? Does the port own them, or the private people own the docks where these boats are sitting beside? Do they pay rent on them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, yes, the docks, there are private and public docks. For instance, right next door to us is Embarcadero, as you may be familiar with.
Yep.
And there's an opportunity as well for abandoned vessels from private marinas as well, because they would fall under the category. And I might go a little bit further in discussing the size of vessels. Normally, if it's a trailerable boat, if it's a small boat, it's a lot easier to dispose of a smaller vessel than it is a larger vessel. The larger vessels, and I'll speak, say, 36 foot and above, especially if it's a, and it could be a state registered boat that is acting as a commercial fishing boat. It can have an Oregon registration and be a commercial fishing vessel. And we have a lot of these in the marinas there at Newport, and so do other ports. So we're not distinguishing between recreation and commercial. It's the idea of being able to give a wide enough berth between the small boat and the large boat. And I would say on the average, you're looking at salmon troll vessels, which are that anywhere from 24 up to 40, 50 foot. And we've had quite a few of those in our port, and I described earlier the three, but it can be private and or public mortgages or anywhere in the port district.
So why couldn't you assess a little more rental fee, charge a little more rental fee, and have some of that applied to these boats? Because I think I've been fished out of Newport many, many times, and you're kind of a unique area where you have more of those boats. Along the Columbia, you won't get those. And a lot of us boat along the Columbia also. So I'm trying to localize it, I guess, is what I'm trying to do. And maybe they need to start doing some of that a little bit. If wherever their boats are docked, just raise the rent a little and then allow for cleaning up your own mess, so to speak.
Chairman Mabry and Representative Zahner, I guess the best answer I can give to that would be the fact that we adjust our mortgage rates according to some of the services that we provide, which that would fall into that category. If we were to increase our rates at this point, it would probably be to make dock improvements or service facility improvements rather than derelict vessels. And that's why we're looking at other tools to try to assist in that process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Byer.
Well, and thank you. My guess is that most of these are probably disposal as opposed to salvage and storage. But do you have problems? I mean, if you pull a boat up with, this goes back to towing companies and all those fun issues that we've dealt with liens, titles, on these that you have to store for a while before you can dispose of them? Is there a pretty hefty expense included in that? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, there is a mechanism in here, and actually it's the same mechanism that exists for law enforcement to deal with the vessels that they have removed. We end up adopting the same mechanism that they have in terms of notice and, you know, who's got the access and the claim on the actual piece of equipment or the vessel. And so there are mechanisms there, and yes, it can be expensive, but in our view, you know, the public policy in play is how are we going to get these vessels out of the water for the safety of boating Oregonians? And then if that's a priority, recognizing that there just aren't the dollars out there to general fund or from the local ports to deal with it, how can we tap into the users, essentially, to get the thing taken care of? So you raise a good issue. I think that ports are more interested in having access to a program to help with that, and are willing to, if they decide to go forward, like if Don handles the Margaret Ann through this program, is willing to deal with all the implications in that in terms of the liens, et cetera. And as a follow-up, I also wanted to mention, because I think it's important, in the Dash 1 amendments that you have, you'll see that the fee structure is being altered slightly, and for boats in excess of 26 feet, we're talking about a $5 fee, as opposed to those smaller boats at $1 fee. So we're trying to shift the balance a little bit more, so it's that's more of a balance between what the larger boats and the smaller boats are paying.
Representative Greenlee?
Try again. Can we talk a little bit about floating homes? They're a part of this under that same scope. How common is that? How do floating homes pay marine license fees as well as other craft?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, you raise a good question, and it was one that we were looking at for potential amendment, ran into a problem with the relating clause. If you want to explore the issue at stake, we'd be happy to have conversations about floating homes and boathouses. The Legislative Council indicated that we could not include that within this bill because of the relating clause.
Either for the removal or the fee.
Correct, sir.
Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And can we call, I'm not sure all of you are together, but we've got three chairs and I got three people on the sign up. Terry Thompson, Paul Don Hefner, and Phil Donovan. And you can go in whatever order you like.
I'm Terry Thompson, past legislator and past lobbyist, now county commissioner for Lincoln County, and also commercial fisherman. Just to give you an idea of the perspective of this, I was sitting here trying to count up the amount of boats in the Yaquina Bay that are derelict. I think the port manager mentioned four, but actually there's two more up another slough, which are sport boats that are about 28 feet long, and four of them that are sitting there waiting to go down that are on private docks. This is a bigger issue than people realize of how many boats that are involved that are basically abandoned vessels. Some still have ownership, and those that have ownership or insurance, we can get to. But those that get to the point where either the person dies and has no heirs, or cases where the person literally just walks off and goes and does something else in his life, they become derelicts in the bay. And they also become pollution problems. If the port can deal with those issues up front, with a small amount of money, it doesn't cost much. But if that vessel goes to the bottom and they have to deal with it as a sunken or submerged vessel, then you have divers, you have to have cranes, you have to go in and do major towing situations. It gets very, very expensive. Now, they're dealing with the ones that are at the port docks. That's where they usually wind up before somebody decides just to take them either to another dock to abandon them or run them up the slough and hide them. And that's what's happened to the other two boats that he hadn't thought of. One's called the Mistress. It's a charter boat that used to be in the Quinna Bay. That's a wooden one. It's a derelict up there. There's also go back up some of the other main parts of the river. So these issues are easy to deal with if there's a small pot of money there for the ports. And I think every port I've fished out of, almost all the ports, have one or two. Some of them are major ones that I think Mr. Don Hefner has some pictures that are pretty elaborate for ones down in Gold Beach, but a lot of them are well hidden back in there that should be taken care of just to clean up pollution. I think it's a good bill. I hope you'll vote for it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Paul Don Heffner, Director of the Marine Board, and I have some photographs. I think perhaps your committee staff's making some copies of them that will illustrate the kind of thing that we're talking here at hand, and I think the picture will tell the story. The Marine Board agrees that there is a problem in the state with regard to derelict and abandoned boats, as well as floating homes and boathouses. Part of the problem is the fact that we have lots of agencies with authority, but oftentimes nobody's really in charge. The list of agencies that have jurisdiction over these cases of abandoned derelict vessels include the U.S. Coast Guard, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the Division of State Lands, DEQ, ourselves, local law enforcement authorities, including sheriffs, port districts, or private marina owners, and possibly others as well, depending on where the vessel is. But the other big part of the problem is a lack of funding, and that's what this bill is designed to address. If a boat sinks in an area where there's active Coast Guard presence and there's any hint of oil pollution, they're quick to respond and usually force the owner to remedy the situation or face civil penalties that can range into thousands of dollars. Likewise, if it sinks in an active navigation channel, an approved navigation channel maintained by the Corps of Engineers, and it's a hazard to navigation, they're usually in a position to cause its removal very, very quickly. However, in other cases where it sinks in a moorage or off channel, where the Coast Guard or the Corps doesn't have much of a federal presence or responsibility, or their interest isn't as clear, or there's no oil pollution from it, or no willing owner, that's where we run into the problem that this bill is designed to try to address. Typically, these are boats of little or no value for salvage purposes. Often, it's difficult, if not impossible, to determine who the owner is. Even if you can determine the owner, suddenly they don't know anything about the vessel, and the yeah. chain of ownership on these things is murky, to say the least. The existing authority that we have authorizes law enforcement authorities to take action to seize the vessel. They provide for due notice and legal process to extinguish ownership in the vessel if the person walks away from it, so that we can avoid claims coming back should the law enforcement authority seize the vessel and cause its removal. So the mechanisms are in place to do that. The problem is that law enforcement agencies typically have better things to do, and they don't have the funding necessary to deal with the cleanup and disposal, which is really the cost of dealing with these vessels that have no salvage value. If they had any value, they wouldn't be there to begin with. In most cases, the sunken boats are sitting on state-owned, submerged, and submersible land owned by the Division of State Lands. Technically, the vessels are trespassing on state lands, but like law enforcement agencies, the Division of State Lands has no real mandate to remove this junk unless they choose to, which was the case in the new Carissa. But in less visible cases, DSL doesn't take an active role over removing this junk from our waterways. So the bill's a step in the direction of trying to provide funding to remove these. It is a problem. We do have a few concerns with the bill that I'd like to elaborate for you. One of the main ones, and I think it's been touched on already, is that of fairness and equity. Currently, we register about 195,000 boats in this state that are used for recreational purposes. Oregon is a small boat state. 85% of those boats are less than 20 feet in length, and so they are not the problem that the bill is trying to address. Typically, the boats that become derelict are large, 26 or 30 feet and over, sometimes quite a bit larger, as you can see in the photographs that I hope you are passing around right now. Typically, they are boats that may have been in commercial use, either as fishing vessels or small tugs, and this bill size caps their size at 200 ton. 200 ton is not your average recreational boat in Oregon. 200 ton is the equivalent of 20,000 cubic feet. That's something on the order of 100 feet long, 20 feet wide, and 10 feet deep. It's big. So boats less than 20 feet, the majority of the boats that we have in the state aren't the problem, but they would be paying for the removal of large vessels that typically don't pay much into the abandoned boat account. While all boat owners might receive some benefit from the removal of derelicts and improvements to navigation, there isn't a real strong linkage between vessel registration for small boats and the removal of derelicts. With that said, however, a $1 per biennium or 50 cent a year fee on all boats is really minimal and wouldn't be noticed by most boat owners. The state of Washington has a similar program for removal of abandoned vessels. They charge $2 per year. So we're looking at a dollar for 2 years versus $2 per year that Washington charges for their program. We would like to suggest a couple of things that might broaden the benefits of the bill and improve that linkage between who benefits and who pays, and would recommend a couple of technical changes as well. The first might be to expand this somewhat to allow for the removal of derelict piling and deadheads that also pose a hazard to navigation. I think that would broaden the benefits to all boaters and overcome some of that problem between who benefits and who pays. Deadheads and the old abandoned pilings and wing dams and things like that are a constant source of boating accidents for people. They lose outdrives on them. Doesn't matter how big or small you are, if you hit one of those, you've got a problem. And so I think broadening it to allow ports and other removal authorities to get into or paying for the removal of some of that might help broaden its appeal. The second, and it's been suggested, would be a cap on the account so that if the demand for removal of these isn't as great as we might think, and we really don't know what it is, that we don't continue to build this account over budget after budget. And I would suggest perhaps a cap of $200,000 so that in any one biennium, if the funds are not fully expanded, we get into a new budget cycle, refill the pot, that any funds in excess of that roll over to our boating facilities account where we could use them for general purpose things such as ramps and restrooms and docks that benefit all boat owners. So there'd be a little more linkage there. Perhaps legislative counsel is correct and we can't expand this to include abandoned floating homes, although they did include it in the measure summary, which surprises me if it's in the measure summary, but we can't change the bill. But I think it would be a good idea to expand it to include floating homes and boathouses. Sometimes these do become derelict and they pose just the same kind of problems, particularly in the Portland metropolitan area, places like Multnomah Channel. These things are a real hazard. They're full of things that you can't dispose of easily, and they're a real mess. If that's done, I would suggest that an appropriate surcharge be placed on floating home titles, which are one-time only titles, so that that community is not being subsidized by boat owners. We'd like to make it clear in the bill that this is a surcharge on boat registration for this specified purpose and not a part of the base boat registration. It's a technical thing, but I think it's important from our perspective as an agency. And finally, we think that the removal authorities portion of it should be broadened so that it's clear that other removal authorities, including sheriffs or other jurisdictions, could participate in this fund, so that if we get instances where we have abandoned or derelict vessels that don't sit within a port district, or if the port is unwilling or unable to cause its removal, that someone else can step up to the plate, or if we've got them in other areas such as the Willamette or up the Columbia or on lakes for that matter, one of these things pops up, we have no port district, that we could still use these funds to deal with the problem in those places. We have discussed some of these changes with the Ports Association. With those proposed amendments, we can support the bill. We'd be happy to work with the ports group and your committee staff if you feel it's appropriate to have those amendments prepared. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
You want to take a question now?
Yeah, I just have a quick question for Paul. We heard your fee bill in Water Committee. So if I'm reading this right, it would be a dollar surcharge on the new fees, because the new fees aren't included in this bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dinkfelder, that is correct. That's a separate measure, and this fee would have to be reconciled with that other bill after session. But that's why we're suggesting that if he changed from the fee structure we have to a surcharge of $1 per boat.
Okay. So what I'm just trying to remember, so the new fee would be, say, for, you know, motorboats less than $12 in length and 12 feet in length, what the dollar amount would be. It's just a dollar surcharge on, and you're asking for what percentage increase?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dinkfelder, the new fee structure that we're proposing goes to a flat fee of $3 per foot.
That's right. Okay. And so it would be a dollar surcharge,
and this would,
on
that. So the fee would be $3 per foot for vessel registration, and if we could craft an amendment, this would be a $1 surcharge on
each,
boat registration.
For the total or for each $3?
No, on the total, $1 surcharge on the total.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Let's go ahead with your testimony.
Chair Mabry. Members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. We've got 17 chapters located around the state, about 2,000 members, many of them, as you might guess, who own small boats. And so the question that I had come here today to pose was is the obvious one of why should a guy with a 12-foot skiff who's puttering around on Lake Billy Chinook be paying a fee to remove derelict vessels in our coastal port communities. And our board considered this legislation last week and was not able to support this legislation as it's currently drafted. Just for your understanding, they were concerned because they didn't know what the scope of the problem was that we were trying to address, what exactly needs resolution, and how these monies would be spent, where the monies would be spent. And we've heard some of that testimony today, but prior to this afternoon, that was all kind of an unknown. And put simply, we would appreciate there to be a little bit more of a public process to build knowledge about what we're trying to address here within the boating community. During the interim, the Oregon Marine Board had an exhaustive public review of their budget situation. And as Representative Dinkfelder mentioned, there's been brought forward a restructuring of the fees at Oregon Marine Board. And we're proud to support that. And it is, quite frankly, a pretty hefty rise in boat registration fees. But the user groups are coming forward unanimously behind it because we recognize the need to make these critical investments in the facilities that we utilize and the enforcement that we ask of the Marine Board and that of the state and the counties that are required to provide that law enforcement. And so this, after having generated that support, this legislation is something that kind of comes out of nowhere. Now, I want to be clear that Ken Armstrong and the courts approached me during the legislative session, but I'm referring to the interim process where we were able to really consider the scope of what we were going to ask of the Oregon Marine Board, what we were going to ask them to do. And so I guess to bring it to a close here, we appreciate that the ports are initiating a conversation here and that there is a problem that needs addressing. We'd just like to have a little bit more due process to be able to consider how, you know, coming up with the issue of money, which is always an age-old question, how that's done, and perhaps done in a manner that provides benefit for all the users who are contributing to it. So with that, I'll close and be prepared to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, the ports offered to match or do a 25% match, I think. Does that help a little bit more? At least you're talking about setting aside, you know, if you come up with some money, then they'd come up with matching a certain percentage of it.
Chair Mabry, Representative, are you referring to line 18 of page 1?
I was referring to it.
Referring to
Janet. Yes, I am. Yeah. Janet says I am, yes.
I mean, I guess the short answer is, you know, that certainly is helpful, that there is a match being proposed. At the same time, when you consider that of the 185,000 vessels that are registered at the Oregon Marine Board, roughly 160 of them are, you know, small craft,
Thank you.
It's difficult to get behind this at this time. it's difficult to do so.
I just wanted to clarify one point in his testimony. Are there really steelhead up in Lake Billy Chinook?
I'm sorry, what's that?
I say, are there really steelhead up in Lake Billy Chinook? Are there steelheaders puttering around up there?
We could have Chair Mabry, Representative Green. We could have a long conversation about Pelton Dam, if you'd like. But you'd probably rather not do so here.
Another
question.
Trawling.
I'm, and I don't mean this in any kind of negative way. Please believe me. But I was at a meeting in Fossil about 2 weeks ago, where the steelheaders were talking about needing access to the navigable rivers, and the farmers say, why should we have to pay for their recreational opportunities? And so what comes around goes around here, if I may add that.
Chair Mabry, I can appreciate that.
This is an unfair world, is what I'm trying to say, I guess.
Well, we've actually been discussing potential fee opportunities, and that's a contentious debate as well.
Yeah.
I think this is one that, quite honestly, we're much more amenable, and as I stated, I want to be clear, we're willing to sit down, work with the ports, and work with other interested jurisdictions on this legislation and craft something that benefits all of the users that are contributing to it. And in many respects, this legislation does benefit all of the users. So I don't want to disregard that and be callous in our opposition. Frankly, it was simply a matter that the legislation kind of came up quickly, hadn't been thoroughly vetted in any sort of public process. I'm a little bit uncomfortable because I represent a while it's a significant grassroots organization, it's a pretty small group as compared to all of the registered boats that exist out there in the state of Oregon. There are, I'm sure, many opinions, and there may be some ideas out there that could really help benefit this legislation and get it moving with consensus support.
I understand. Don Hefner, a question for you. You alluded to some things, some changes you thought needed to be made in the bill. We just got the Dash 1 amendments today. I assume you have not looked at those. And so it's probably an unfair question, but I'll ask it anyway. Do these changes, you think, reflect the concerns that you had in the bill, or is it premature to even ask that question?
Mr. Chairman, this is the first I've actually seen
the LC
amendments. However, I did work with Ken Armstrong and the Ports Group to suggest some of these changes. I think these go a long way towards some of the concerns we have. However, I don't believe they reflect the notion of a cap, for example, on the account, or the notion of trying to broaden the scope of it to include derelict piling and other things. Now, perhaps the relating clause is too narrow. We'd like to explore that, but these go partway to the concerns in my testimony.
Okay, and one final question I had was, and I imagine I didn't follow the question correctly, but Representative Greenfield I just combined two there, didn't I? anyway.
Not quite.
Not quite. I came close. Dinkfelder. At any rate, that's not my question. My question is, the title of the bill, or the relating clause, does include floating homes and houseboats, but the question earlier had to do with fees charged to houseboats. Is that
why I was asking about the disposal of them and where the structure of their fees came? Because that's where you could add.
Okay, and the answer to that was that this includes the disposal, but not fees for those. Is that correct,
Mr. Chairman? Representative Greenlick, the Marine Board issues titles for floating homes and boathouses. It's a one-time only title fee. And the bill as drafted does not charge a fee of floating homes and boathouses.
Yeah, but we were told it was because of the relating clause.
Well,
my guess is it was which section that's amended is the problem in the relating clause. It must be a different section.
I think we have a second string.
Well, Armstrong's the one that made up that answer, so we don't want to make him.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, it does include the terms floating homes in the summary.
the relating clause deals with abandoned boats.
Okay.
And when we went back to get the dash ones and we asked more specifically about a fee for floating homes and boathouses, legislative council came back and said you can't do that.
Thank you.
Because the relating clause is not broad enough. Why it's in the summary, I don't know, but that's what was a relating clause issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Ask one more quick one. How do you determine when the boat's abandoned? When it's
it looks
when
like
you start looking at. Well, I know you have to wait. No, but do you have to wait that long?
That's my question, Tom.
That's an abandoned boat you got in your hand.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, my other thought is if you had some of those seals that are always on the dock and put them in the boat, it wouldn't sink quite as
well. Well, there's always a question of whether it's a tourist attraction or an abandoned boat too. But they sort of.
I wanted to mention one time you have to wait before you can say, "Hey, that guy looks like he's getting in trouble, and maybe we ought to start."
It's a process you have to go through.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Zauner, in ORS Chapter 830, in the section on abandoned boats, there are some criteria in there for defining abandoned.
I'll read that. I wanted to mention one thing. You know, there was some mention here of inequities between small boats and large boats. Remember, a lot of these people that are boat owners that have 45-foot boats that are ORS, that are ocean-going boats, they feel like they're paying an equitable amount because they're laying out a large sum of money, a relatively large sum of money, while most of the states are building boat ramps in Idaho or over and in the along the Snake River or Detroit Lake, which they'll never use. So it just depends on which side of the issue you're on, whether you feel it's inequitable or not. And I think it's knowing Phil Donovan's group and knowing him as representation, give him a little bit, they'll come to a reasonable answer.
Was there anyone else who wished to speak on this issue? Seeing none, we will declare the club hearing closed. And let's see, we have more business.
Yeah.
Okay.
Advisory committee reports.
Oh, okay. Okay, we have. Did you need to leave?
I do need to leave. Get to the other committee.
Okay. Sorry, but we're going to go ahead and hear this other issue. Okay, you can go ahead with your.
I speak up quickly. It's not because anything you said.
Oh, that's opinion of Darren Vessels.
I've learned.
Mr. Chair, members, again, Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Ports Group. I'm here today to talk to you very briefly about the Freight Advisory Committee under the Oregon Department of Transportation, which for the last 2 years I chaired. Now, it wasn't too long ago in this session that I was before you to give an overview on the Freight Advisory Committee, on what our activities have been for the past couple of years. And I said at that time that when our final report was done, we would bring that to you, and I'd go over that briefly with you. I don't see much of a need to spend a great deal of time going over it because I summarized almost everything that was in that contents, and you had several pertinent questions, and we covered a lot of that material. But I do want to let you know that you have that in your hands. We feel very strongly as a committee that this is a good work product. It's not long, but the material in there is, I think, very to the point and has done a good job in raising the profile of freight interests within Oregon and within the Department of Transportation. I will remind you that two of the probably most significant things that are in this report are in the appendixes. That's Appendix 4 and Appendix 5, back on pages 22 and pages 25. Appendix 4 is our recommendations relative to T21, the Transportation Equity Act, back in Congress. And these are our priorities, our recommendations for that process. And then on page 25, selected projects that enhance freight mobility statewide. I think you'll find that this is the first time that we have ever had a meaningful short list, if you will, of projects statewide that deal with freight, freight mobility, and that kind of thing. So, again, it's a report that we're proud of. Matt Garrett here with the Department of Transportation. He and his staff have done an excellent job of being at our disposal, staffing the work of the Freight Advisory Committee, and this report actually reflects considerable hard work and sweat equity on their part. So I want to publicly say thank you to Mr. Garrett for that help. If you scan this, I think you'll find it's a good document. We are going to continue to push forward any transportation funding packages this session. We want to be part of that discussion. We will be part of that discussion. The only other thing I will point out to you is that the Freight Advisory Committee sunsets December 31st of 2005. So you'll see us back before you again next session. I expect to extend the sunset or to have it eliminated. This was an experiment, and I think the experiment has proved to be one with good results. And I hope you you appreciate the product as much as we do, and recognize the hard work that a lot of folks in both the public sector and the private sector have contributed to this. And with that, we commend this report into your capable hands, and I'd be happy to answer any additional questions that you might have.
Mr. Chairman, Matthew Garrett with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Just echoing Mr. Armstrong, bottom line is the collective wisdom brought to the table by this committee has made the decision-making process at ODOT and our Transportation Commission better. Bringing the various components of freight around the table has focused the conversation to the point that you now have the trucking industry, the rail industry talking to each other. So it's been a very aggressive year in process. That's what's reflected in the document. We are better for it. Ken raises a good point with regard to the sunset. I think we would benefit if the sunset would go away. It's been a very good process. We're proud of it. And I thank Mr. Armstrong for his dedication for 2 years. He was the chair of this committee.
Questions, anyone? Gosh, you guys are good.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate you being here. I think that ends our business.
Nobody left, right?
We're adjourned.
Thank you, everybody.